Thank you, Lisa. I know some of you are already thinking, I want to see how he's going to get through this morning. It's an exciting passage. I was sharing portions of it with Lisa this weekend and with Tempa, and there's just so much in here, and that's true of every chapter of our Bible. This book can never be exhausted as long as we live, and the challenge is to each of us is to be in it and trying to exhaust it as much as we can in our own lives. The year was 1982. It was around November, I believe, if I recollect properly. Tempa had flown to Hawaii. Well, she flew from Missouri to Los Angeles to Hawaii, and her last leg was from Hawaii to beautiful American Samoa, Pango Pango, in the Southwest Pacific. That day, we had just gotten in the day before, and we were waiting to offload our ship. A horrible, violent storm swept through the island. You see, from November up to about February is cyclone season in the South Pacific, much the same as in our story we're going to see this morning. From October through February, ships did not sail. Paul knew that. Paul tried to tell them, now's not a good time, fellers. We knew that. We were back in the safety of the island and had been swept in by a storm. Well, this storm had circled back around, as is typical in the South Pacific, and it was raging against the island of Samoa. My lovely, sweet Tempa was flying in that evening, and my heart just sank as I was at the airport with this storm just raging, 120-mile-an-hour winds. The last plane that had tried to land in a storm like that was in the lagoon right next to the air landing strip, because you can't land there. The landing strip is built off outside the island so that as you come in and attempt to land, you got to get that plane down, slam on the brakes, hit reverse, and stop that thing. Or your other option is, if you hit the runway and you know you aren't going to make it, you got to power up and pray, because you got to get up over the mountain. So here comes my sweetie. I could see the plane, the lights on the plane like this, and just praying, oh Lord, please bring her in safely. I watched as the plane came and tried and full power up and missed the mountain. Oh, praise God. I can't take much more of this. Here it comes again. I see the lights circling, circling, circling. Here it comes again. Same thing. Two times. Oh, that's unheard of. Oh, they made it out two times. Third time. Here they come again. One more time they're going to try. And the plane almost made it, but just couldn't. It just powered up and just barely, you could just... It's... I knew I couldn't tell this stupid story. This is what Paul and the men on this ship were going through. They made it out of there again and flew on to Fiji. I found out later the reason that they were commanded to land is the American Samoans owed the Fijians money. The storm wasn't in Fiji, which was just about 30 minutes away, and it was okay to land there, but they're going to confiscate all their cargo, their plane, their passengers, everything, because they owe them money. So they land in Fiji, much shaken, believe me. They confiscated the plane and all the stuff on it, had a couple of beat-up old dilapidated buses that barely ran, loaded Tempa and all the passengers on these two buses, took them downtown to a hotel that was worse than the buses. Tempa said that after she had pulled herself together somehow, she thought a shower, a nice warm shower, that'll help relieve stress. And she said all she could think about is they kept telling them, we're going to try to make her back in there tomorrow, folks. You know, and she's thinking, oh, God, just get me home. So she went in to take a shower, and it just... And she had, you know, so that was a bad story. So the next day, they cleaned all the cargo off the plane, and they released them to come back. Well, that day, the storm had passed. It was clear. Well, wouldn't you know it, that evening, as they had planned it to fly back in, the storm circled around yet another time. Here they come again in the full force of this gale. This time, the pilot... I don't know what this guy, he was doing some powerful praying. He slammed that thing down and stopped it, and stopped the plane. People literally, I could see people literally coming down the gangway and hitting the ground, kissing the ground, crawling off of that plane. Now, all of this story to tell you that we unloaded my boat for whatever reason, because there was a big run of fish and there were no other boats at the cannery. We were able to unload like in 6 days. We got all our fish off, which... is really working. 1,200 ton of fish off the boat, 12 days, washed, fueled, food, ready to go again. What do you think Tempa said? I'm going on the boat with you. I am not flying out of here on Pango Pango's Spia Air. I'm not doing it. I hate the boat. Yeah, baby, I know you hate the boat. I'm going on the boat. So she went on the boat with us. Well, that typhoon had passed. And I don't know if any of you remember 1982, the end of November, the typhoon that took out the Hawaiian Islands. We ended up in the middle of that before it hit Hawaii. Tempa, we'd been out 3 weeks. We had several hundred ton of fish on the boat. We were doing real well. And all of a sudden, here comes one of these South Pacific typhoons. And you don't get away from it. There's nowhere to go. And we were just running dead slow. I mean, just barely moving, going into this thing, and these waves just pouring over the whole ship, just shaking the entire ship, just feels like it's going to shake apart. And I remember Temp and I were sitting in bed having some popcorn and a Pepsi watching a movie. I mean, what else do you do in a typhoon, right? You aren't going anywhere. Everything's buttoned down. And all of a sudden, when you hit what are called freak ground swells, I mean, the storm's raging and you're just boom every time you hit one. You're just trying to keep your bow into it. And it's just boom. But every once in a while you get what's called sneakers. These are big ground swells. The captain's brother, who was a non-Christian and hated Christianity, that night we just happened to have on the Big Ten, the Ten Commandments. Captain put it on for Temp and I. He just thought it'd be something we'd like to watch. And so Jim, the captain's brother, one of his older brothers, he was on the wheel watch. And so he's just sick of, he went downstairs, got a coffee, saw the Ten Commandments, started cursing God and me and everybody else, went back up with his coffee, and he said, man, we're going to be here forever. And I don't know what he was thinking, but he speeded up the boat a little bit. And I could feel the engine speed up a little bit. Shortly thereafter, it was just death. Ba-boom. And then one more. Ba-boom. And it just shudders and stops the ship. And I told Tempe, and I could hear just a giant collision. It knocked out up on our running bridge. It knocked all the windows out. The ocean from outside was now inside and making its way down from topside down to the bottom. And my room was on a corner where all the water from upstairs came down the upstairs passageway, down the central passageway, and it was heading for my room. And Tempe said, are we abandoning ship? What do we do? And I ran over and I could just feel it. And I said, throw me some towels. And so she rolled out of bed and crawled into the bathroom. And she threw me some towels and I shoved them in the bottom of the door and held onto the door. And I could feel the force of that wave hit our door. Ba-boom. And then wash on down the hallway. And I thought, oh, this is really bad. I mean, this is really bad. So we go up topside. They had turned the ship kind of away from the straight into it. And we're kind of, now we're sideways, just getting just thrashed in this storm. It had knocked all of our windows out, took out all of our electronics. We went upstairs to check the helicopter. It had busted the front bubble on the helicopter, but it was still there, miraculously. Temple had been praying to get off the ship. She wanted off the ship. And what had happened this particular trip, we'd only been out a few weeks. This particular trip, I had a bunch of fish that we normally throw over, like mahi-mahi, all that great fish that you eat now and pay $20 for in the restaurant for a fresh piece. I had all of that fish to sell, and I wanted Tempa to go sell it at the fish market on American Samoa. But something happened. I read in the paper, and we were at a church service, and the pastor there was a young fellow from Springfield, from Assembly of Gods. He was there serving as a pastor to the American Samoan Bible College, which was bringing young men from all over the islands to train them and then send them back to pastor and teach God's word. Well, he just happened to make a mention at the end of his message that if any of you have any food or you can spare anything, the Bible College is out of food and they desperately need food. Food. I got food. I got fish. I wonder if they want fish. So after church, I went up and asked him, I said, Pastor, would you guys be interested in some fish? He said, are you kidding me? He said, that'd be like a T-bone in Texas, man. So they came down with three or four little trucks, filled them up, filled up their freezers, and that was what happened to us, actually. In 3 weeks, they'd been eating, I mean, they had all this fish, and they were inviting others, and they ate all the fish, ran out of fish, started praying for God to bring Chuck's boat back. Here comes this cyclone like we'd never seen before, wiped us out, because normally you just button down and you just ride through them and get to the other side of it and keep fishing. But not this one. This one took us out. And when they saw our boat coming in, they're all praising them, praise the Lord, you know, and they're all waiting on the dock, praise the Lord. And so I told them, I said, fellas, we got to get this praying straightened out. I said, I know my wife's a powerful prayer warrior, But I know it was you. They said, oh, yes, Pastor, we've been praying 24 hours around the clock. We've been praying as a body for more fish, and we love you. And I said, all right, here's the deal. You just wiped out my whole boat to get more fish. I will gladly give you more fish. Now, you have to pray, because I happen to be on a boat here where the captain and half of the crew are a bunch of potheads. We take more marijuana out with us than we do provisions to eat. And there's no way that we can get this boat back in for Christmas. And they said, you will be back for Christmas. We will pray as we have been praying. I said, okay, well, that'd be a good thing. So we got the boat fixed. Poor Tempa, she couldn't fly home because Hawaii's wiped out. So she had to wait several days after we left, and by the time she got to Hawaii, and things were just chaos, she caught a plane to San Diego and had to rebook everything, and that was chaos. She booked her flight into Branson, Missouri, and there was an ice storm or fog, ice storm or something, so she had to land in Joplin. She lands in Joplin, takes a bus to Springfield. George Ann, where's George Ann? George Ann picks her up, brings her home, and I call. I say, hey, baby, the boat's full. You ready to come back? I will kill you. So there's our horror story on the South Seas. I have been in many, many vicious storms, and this story speaks to my soul. Luke's detailed account of the voyage and shipwreck of Paul on his way to Rome is considered one of the most descriptive pieces of literature in all of the New Testament. And it corresponds with another story that is so dear to my heart, the book of Jonah. When I went through seminary, my third semester, which is a year of Hebrew, and then the next year, which would be third semester, Dr. Rick Taylor said, welcome, fellas. How are you liking Hebrew? Oh, yeah, like a headache, you know? And he said, well, by the end of this class, you've had 1 year of Hebrew. By the end of this class, you will translate the book of Jonah. And I thought, yeah, right. Where do I get out of this place? But we did translate the book of Jonah. In the book of Jonah, chapter 1, it's the high drama of Acts chapter 27. And I love it in Hebrew because in the Hebrew, they call the sailors old salts. They're called old salts in Hebrew. And the captain is called the chief roper. He's the man that knows the tackle and knows how to fight the storms. And in Jonah's day, they're in the same Mediterranean Sea, same type of a vicious storm brought about by God, just like that. Here, I believe Satan brings about this storm, trying to take out Paul, because you remember back in 23:11, God said, Jesus standing next to Paul's side, encouraging him, as you have testified here in Jerusalem faithfully, you also will testify in Rome. Satan can't take him out, and Paul will get to Rome. And it won't be next week, because next week is Palm Sunday, and the week after is Easter, and the week after is Ascension. We're going to have to leave off Paul in our last chapter, chapter 28, but we've got some high drama here this morning. Paul's voyage and shipwreck, Acts 27, 1-44. Temple liked this picture so much, I think we're ordering a poster size of this to put on our kitchen wall. And she never says that about anything I usually find, but she loves this picture. She wants a copy of this picture. The voyage from Caesarea to Crete is the first thing that we look at here. Festus, having decided that Paul must be taken on to Rome to stand before Caesar, we've covered that the last few weeks, Paul's trials, haven't we? And all of them, amazingly, have said what about him? Not guilty, not guilty, not guilty of anything. Well, then why is it off to Rome we go, chained to Roman soldiers? Because that's how God's going to get him there. God had to put him under Roman arrest to protect him from the Jews who were going to put him to death. So he's being protected, and God's going to get him there. The custody of Paul and some other prisoners, as we've Lisa read here in chapter 27, verse 1, it was decided that we should sail for Italy. They proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. So Paul and other prisoners were given to this individual by the name of Julius. He's a centurion that belonged to, it says, to the Augustus order. Really, Augustus means the imperial regiment. This is one of the hand-picked few of Caesar that guarded Caesar and also saw to special missions and were sent out for Caesar. Julius belonged to this elite group with special, especially representing the emperor. And he may have been in charge of especially transporting high political prisoners around the empire. kind of like one of our federal marshals today. We all saw that movie, what was it called, Federal Marshal? Marshals, or I don't remember the name of that movie, but a top movie. Everyone's supposed to say, I don't know, we don't watch movies, right? Yeah, right. If anybody knows the name, just holler out the name of that movie. Anyway, it may also be as Ramsey, a famous Old Testament, New Testament scholar from England. In his book, St. Paul the Traveler and Roman Citizen, he suggests that Julius was a frumentarian. A frumentarian is one who was in charge over these grain ships, cargo. They would join themselves to grain ships and get the grain safely to Rome. A very high office in imperial service to the granaries of Rome. It may be, and any of this is conjecture other than the fact that knowing that he was one of the special cohort, one of the centurions, a right-hand man picked by Caesar to protect Caesar and carry out special duties for Caesar. Julius and his prisoners boarded a ship of Adramyttium, which was evidently returning to its home port. The Adramyttium was a seaport of Mysia, southeast of Troas. Let me put the sea voyage up here for us on a map, and we'll refer to it as we move through here. Paul left Caesarea, where he had been in prison, held in jail or loose confinement, if you will, for 2 years, and he sailed up the coast to Sidon. And from Sidon, they sailed over to Myra, because in Myra, they're going to pick up a deep water ship, a granary from Myra that will take them up to Rome, or so was the plan, as we'll see. From Myra, they end up being caught and swept down to the island of Crete and Fair Haven. And then their attempt was, because the storms were coming and it was so bad, they said, well, if we can just get around the corner here to Phoenix as a better harbor. And I don't know about this for sure of why Fair Haven. Fair Haven, in the name itself, would suggest that it was a fair haven. It was fair to winter. It was protected. But I personally think that they didn't have as many bars and brothels for the sailors to hang out in. A much better place is just around the corner in Phoenix. Let's get to Phoenix. And so that's why the ship's personnel, the captain, the owner, and the sailors, they all, let's get to Phoenix. And so they don't listen to Paul, as we're going to see, and stay in Fair Haven. Now, as they attempt to get around the corner to get to Phoenix, we all know the story, and we're going to read it here. They get caught by this violent wind and are going to be swept to sea. And the amazing thing about their course of travel is how the wind drives them. They expected to get blown into North Africa, into the coast here, which is filled with shallows and reefs and just filled with danger, as we're going to see. But look at the course, how they get blown along here and end up here at the island of Malta. So that's where we're going on this voyage. And the ship, the major granary ships, ran from Alexandria, Egypt, to Myra. And then from Myra, they would sail around here and come up to deliver their grains into Italy. So that's where they're going to catch this second big ship once they get to Myra. So Caesarea to Myra then. The ship that they end up on here, this Adramyttian ship, is probably what we call a coasting ship. It stayed in close along the shore and just kind of coasted its way up. They'd catch a little favorable wind, and they followed in for the protection of the coastline. It was no deep water ship. They didn't go out into the ocean. So they're going to follow the coast around to get over to Myra, is where they're heading. And don't miss, as we go through this passage, these we sections. We, that's our author, isn't it? That's Luke. Luke is on this ship as well. Embarking, verse 2, in this Adramyttian ship, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. Two interesting things here in verse 2 that caught my attention is that Luke is on the ship, and many commentaries surmise that he would have signed on as the ship's physician so he could stay with Paul. He'd been with Paul for the 2 years in Caesarea, hadn't he? He'd probably written by now the Gospel of Luke. He had written the book of Acts up till now, and he's going to give us a first-hand account, which I don't read in here anywhere, like, what am I doing on this boat? That's what Tempest said to me after that storm hit us. What in the world am I doing here? Well, it was either this baby or the airplane. Oh, that's right. Yeah. And I still got to get back, go back there and get on another airplane. But Luke is here with him. And another one that really jumps out at me is this young man, Aristarchus. He's a Macedonian from Thessalonica. He is from the church plant that Paul planted in Thessalonica, and Paul hasn't been able to shake this young man since. What a blessed thing that is. This young fellow, in fact, many suppose for him to have accompanied Paul as a prisoner on the ship, what would he have to be? Paul's slave. Paul's personal attendant. He had made himself a bondslave of the Apostle Paul, just as Paul had made himself a bondslave of the Lord Jesus Christ. What a beautiful picture. Aristarchus, from the day he first heard Paul in the salvation message, said, "Where you go, I go. Your God is my God." Reminds me of the Old Testament account of Naomi and Ruth, doesn't it? What a beautiful picture. Do you love Jesus Christ in that way? Since the first day you've heard of him, have you attached yourself to someone who loves Jesus? Attach yourself to somebody. Get in a Bible study. I'd love to have 10 or 12 young guys driving me crazy. It's a great thing. And some of you ladies, get attached to Bible study fellowship or Friday precepts. There's studies all around for us so that we will get engaged and truly become disciples of Jesus Christ. That's what Aristarchus is doing. He's sticking with Paul. And interestingly enough, he's going to ride with him to Rome. And when Paul writes the letters to Colossae and some of these other letters, guess who he's going to send them with? The letters he writes from prison in Rome for the 2 years he's there. He's going to send them with Aristarchus and other young men that are there that get saved. He sends them with them. That's a beautiful thing. So the next day, verse 3, we put in at Sidon. So as we saw on the map, they left Caesarea and they sailed up to Sidon, which is about 67, 70 miles up the coast. And in coming to Sidon, it says that Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. There's a Christian church in Sidon. And Paul gets off the ship, and probably under guard, and went to visit the Christian church there. And they are known as the Friends. This becomes a technical term for Christians, kind of like followers of the way. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." So the followers of the way, they're called here in Sidon. This church called themselves the Friends of Jesus. Just a different name. And Paul gets to go visit them. And Julius lets him do that. Isn't it interesting, especially through the book of Acts, each of our centurions have been painted in a very favorable light, haven't they? They're intelligent men. They're commanders over troops. They're in a position of tremendous authority, and yet they are good to Paul and the other Christians, aren't they? Every time we've been introduced to one. And Luke doesn't want us to miss that. So here Julius lets Paul go to visit friends. And from there then, so they stay there, they unload some grain, unload some wares, take some more wares on. Doesn't say how long they were there, a day, maybe two. Not long. But they leave there, and they're going to head on up from Sidon. They're going to sail over to Myra following the coast. Verse 5, verse 4. From there, we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. So they sailed up and around Cyprus because of the strong westerly winds that were blowing at this time. And when we'd sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. And so they come up here, they land in Myra, which is in the district of Lycia, and this is the most prominent part of the Asian continent, which is today modern Turkey. And they put in here, and this was, as I said, the major port that took all this traffic from Alexandria up. They'd sail straight north to Myra, and then they'd make their trip up and over to Rome. The grain, the people in Rome, they wanted bread and games, didn't they? Bread and games, especially at this time in Roman history. When we sailed through the sea, they come to Lycia, verse 6, and there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. And when we had sailed slowly for a good many days, with difficulty, had arrived off of Cnidus, Since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmon. And so they get on this ship and they head from Myra, and they really want to sail directly west, but the winds are contrary to them, and the winds are shifting and pushing them in a southerly direction. So they shoot and they try to steer towards Crete, coming under the protection of Crete, and they're able to do that. And then the voyage from Crete to Malta. Paul's advice rejected. verse 9, when considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. At this point in the story, the sailors and the captain and the ship owner are still in control. We know from first century documents that at this time in history, there was a bonus that was paid to ship owners if they would risk getting one more load of grain into Rome. We need more grain. There's going to be a number of months where we're going to be out of grain. Anyone that'll take the risk will make it worth your while. And of course, boat owners are going to do that. It's a gamble. And they were more inclined to listen to the pilot, the captain of the ship, the chief roper, and the ship's owner, the centurion. Notice here, who has the ultimate say? Julius does, doesn't he? So it would give some support to the fact that he is in charge of the granaries and overseeing this for Caesar. He ultimately is in charge, but he takes more credence from what the ship's personnel are having to say. And so they make a decision. He doesn't listen to Paul at this point. And Paul here is not speaking under inspiration. If we said that, then we got a problem, don't we? Because Paul says we're going to lose the ship, the cargo, and our lives. But in the end of the story, we're going to find not one of them are lost. Because God sends an angel to Paul in the night, as we're going to see here in just a minute. And he tells him the ship and the cargo are all going to be lost, but not one of you will be lost. What a beautiful thing. Not one of you will be lost. So here Paul, just with his own shipping experience, his own sailing experience and expertise, and just being familiar with the Mediterranean, everybody knows, these ship's personnel know, this centurion know, that from October through February, you do not attempt to get out here on the Mediterranean. You don't do it. And we're going to find out why here in just a minute. So they're persuaded by the others rather than by Paul. Verse 12, because the harbor that they were in, and that's the harbor of Fair Havens, back up there in verse 8, they had made it into Fair Havens. Because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there. If somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. That's just up around the corner. You think, well, no big deal. We should be able to do that. That's what they thought. And if everything would have went the way they were planning, they could have reached it. They would have been safe. But God had other plans. We're going to be introduced to this violent northeaster wind that comes down through there at this time. The reason why nobody ships or sails on the Mediterranean during these months, we're going to be introduced to one of those right now. It's like the cyclone in the South Pacific. You don't want to be out there in November, December, January, because you'll end up in one of those cyclones. But when you have a tuna boat that's costing you $250,000 a week, it's time to go, boys. And you button down the hatches and you go. And so that's what we're faced with here. The owner's looking at the risk involved. It looks like they convince themselves, don't they? If only we might somehow be able to get from here up around the corner and make it to Phoenix. And again, I'm saying to you, the reason they wanted to go there is they had more pubs and brothels for the sailors. Because that's who's in charge and that's who's doing the speaking here. They wanted to get there. There wasn't anything down there in Fair Havens. It was a suitable harbor, but there was no action. Action for the boys. We got to be here 3 months until the shipping lanes are open and it's safe to travel again. So let's get up to Phoenix. And that's what they're trying to do. The violent storm. Verse 13, when a more moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had gained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete, close inshore. But before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called Euroquilo. Euroquilo is a hybrid word. Euro means east, and that's Greek, and quilo is Latin, meaning nor'easter, so it's an east nor'easter. And so if we were, let me see, here's west to you all, west, east, north. So the winds were coming from, the trade winds were coming from out of the west. And it was tough, it's tough to have wind coming this way trying to sail that way, isn't it? But now they got a southwester. They got some wind out of the southwest, and they started moving around the island, and they thought they gained their purpose. But then here come this cursed northeaster. And it's a cold wind. It comes up from out of the north and the east, and it come violently roaring down through there. And off the island of Crete has 7,000-foot high peaks. And those winds come down through those mountainous peaks. They were on the lee side of the island trying to sneak just around the corner. If we can just get around the corner. And they almost made it until they got hit by this nor'easter. And this nor'easter, the reason it's so ferocious is there's nothing you can do against it. It stirs up the sea, and it's going to drive them straight into the North African coast, is what they think. So this wind rushes down, and when the ship was caught up in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. There's nothing else you can do, people. Like us on the, we had a large tuna boat, and we just button everything down, and we're just barely moving, running into it. And you don't want to try to run away from it on a tuna boat, because some of these swells are so big, they drive you under, I mean, literally underwater, if you can imagine that. And it gets even worse over around the Philippines. I've heard of destroyers and aircraft carriers getting swamped by these seas. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a violent, ferocious storm that comes against them. And they had nothing else they could do. They let themselves give way and be driven by it. So the wind catches them here. This nor'easter comes down upon them, catches them, and starts driving them towards the African coastline. And then verse 16, running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. And after they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Sirtis, they let down the sea anchor, and so let ourselves be driven along. Several things happen here. They come under the lee of Clautis, this small island right here called Clautis. When they come around the lee of that island, they're trying to get a little steerage way, and the island blocks the storm just for a little bit. They're still being swept along by it, but it gives them just enough time to get the dinghy, the lifeboat that they were hauling behind them on a rope. It's been just swamped in these seas, and I think it was all hands on deck to haul this thing in and try to rescue and save it. Notice Luke says when we were barely able to get this thing up. So it seems like the passengers now, everyone's pressed into service to try to save their lives. They ran supporting cables under the ship. These are large ropes that they ran underneath the ship and pulled and tied off, trying to hold the ship together throughout the length of the ship. Because these ships are not made to be pounded by a storm like this. I've been in these storms, and I go down into my engine room on the large tuna boats. These are steel ships. And you can see this thing when you can see it like this down below from the engine room. And you just think, oh my, I sure hope they put a little extra weld on these joints. You can literally see it like that moving. So after they did all of this and did all that they could possibly do, they threw a big sea anchor off the stern, which is like a big parachute, and it tries to slow the ship down, because their next worry and concern is they're going to end up on the shallows of Sirtis. And right down in here are the shallows of Sirtis throughout this area, treacherous reefs. History tells us of all the ships that are piled up on the shallows of Sirtis. So that's their next thought, is we're caught in this nor'easter, it's going to blow us right down here into the coast of Africa, right into the shallows of Sirtis. And they're scared to death about that. Verse 18, the next day as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to throw the cargo overboard with their own hands. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. And since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope of our being saved was abandoned. There's no hope. There's no hope for us. The ship's going to break up. And I imagine this thing was leaking like a sieve. They had the bucket brigades trying to keep the water out of this thing. They're throwing the cargo over to try to lighten the ship, get it up out of the water more so it's not drawing so much draft, because this thing's busting open. It's leaking. It's, you know, everybody down below and stick your fingers in a hole type thing. And then everyone else that's free, get a bucket, pass them up. Let's get this thing bailed out. Verse 21. When they'd gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in their midst and said, "Men, I told you so." I don't ever get to say that to anybody. Tempa gets to say it to me all the time. I don't know why that is. I'm sure that's not true in any of your homes, is it? All right, gals, quit giving the guys the elbows now. Knock it off. You're just lucky Donna's not there, Michael. You'd be getting one, too. More bruises. I told you so. But don't you have to relish that sometimes when you tell somebody, don't follow this course of action? And they go ahead anyway. And then when it turns bad on them, then we can say, and we don't do that around here. We just pray for you. And we're not going to tell you I told you so, because we don't want you to leave. You already know it, right? I mean, you already know it. You don't need somebody to tell you. That's what I tell my wife. You don't need to do that. I already know. So Paul just, he couldn't stand it, though. I told you. Did I not urge you to not do that? And now, verse 22, I urge you to keep up your courage, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. How do you know that? This very night, last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, he stood before me saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. This goes back to 23:11. You remember the last time that Jesus himself stood next to Paul, encouraging him when he was under arrest in Jerusalem. His people wouldn't listen to him. They wanted to do nothing but kill him. Jesus showed up and said, Paul, you will testify in Rome. And now here, how gracious our God is to say, I'm going to take the ship, I'm going to take the cargo and everything on it, but not one person will be lost because they're attached to you, Paul. It made me think of an application. Because we are attached to Jesus Christ, there is no loss of life and no destruction for you and I. He will bring us safely through, saved forever to dwell with him. Do you see the illustration there? All of those that we can get to attach themselves and trust in Jesus, they're with us. We will all be spared from death and destruction. And you say, well, what is death for the Christian? It's passing into his presence. And what a day that'll be. But death and destruction awaits all those who are outside of Christ. And death and destruction is not going to visit them this day because of the grace of God to spare them because of Paul. And Paul said to them, and the angel went on to say, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep up your courage, men. I mean, this is a typical preacher, right? This guy really believes what God's telling him. Keep up your courage, men, for I believe God. It will turn out exactly as I have been told. How can I say that to you? Because all of these years I've been walking with him, this has been true of my relationship with him. When he gives me a promise, he stands good on it. You can take it to the bank. So Paul goes on to tell them about this and continues with his encouragement. But we must run aground on a certain island. Okay? Then we aren't going to end up on the shoals of North Africa or be ripped to pieces by the shoals. We're going to end up on a certain island. What island is that? I don't know. He didn't tell me. But we're going to come across an island and we're going to hit it. And so that brings us to the land being detected. Verse 27, when the 14th night had come, and as we were being driven along in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. When you're at sea, and you've been at sea, and you only smell salt air, when you get anywhere near land, and you get a wind off the land, you can smell it. It's an exciting thing, too, by the way. When you come from out in the middle of the ocean, and you could smell land before you ever see it. And that's what the sailors, right away, they know that land's coming. So they took soundings. They took a piece of lead with a hollowed out bottom with a rope on it, and it would have knots every 6 foot. It would have a knot. And they'd throw that out in front of the ship, and then they'd walk it back, and they'd pull it back up, and another guy would count the number of fathoms. And so it turns out to be the sounding was 20 fathoms. 6 feet to a fathom, 6 feet to a fathom times 20, that's 120 foot deep. They went on another half an hour or so, and they threw it out again. This time it came back 15 fathoms, 90 feet. And they said, uh-oh, it's getting shallow here. There is certainly land coming, and we're going to get ripped to pieces on it. Verse 29, fearing they might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast out four anchors from the stern and began to wish for daybreak. That's praying. Not wishing, that's praying. Different sailors were praying to their different gods because you can't see. It's pitch black out there. They've been in this horrible storm. Now they're coming up on this island. They throw out all the anchors they got left off the stern to try to slow the ship down and get it to stop, which it apparently does, and then they're hoping for daybreak. Now, as the sailors were trying to escape from the ship, they let down the ship's boat into the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow. Paul said this to the centurion and to the soldiers, unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved. Unless you remain with Jesus Christ, folks, unless you truly accept him and remain with him, you cannot be saved. And so the soldiers now, who takes over? Who's in charge now? The soldiers are in charge. Immediately, the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it fall away. Are they listening to Paul now? You bet they're listening to Paul now. And they are in charge, not the sailors anymore. The sailors are deserting. They said, you know, forget these landlubbers. Let's save ourselves. Let's get out of here. Let's take the ship's boat. It was just a group of them that were trying to sneak out of there. And Paul, how did he know that? I'm assuming the Lord told him, Paul, keep them on the boat. Whoever's attached to you lives. Whoever's not attached to you, then none of them will be saved. Okay? And so they're listening to him. And until day was about to dawn, Paul kept encouraging them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you've been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation. Not a hair from the head of any of you shall perish. Excuse me. And having said this, he took bread, gave thanks to God in the presence of all. He broke it and began to eat. What a picture of the Last Supper. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 11 right here. This is Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the picture of the Last Supper, taking the bread, breaking it, giving thanks to God, and then passing it out to be shared. That's what Paul does here. Verse 37, all of us in the ship were 226 persons at all, 276 persons. That's a big ship, 276 people, and not one of them will be lost. And when they had eaten enough, and they began to lighten the ship by throwing out all the wheat into the sea, and when day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a certain bay with a beach, and they resolved to drive the ship up unto it if they could. And casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea, while at the same time they were loosening the ropes for the rudders and hoisting the little foresail that they had left into the wind. They attempted to head the ship into the beach. But they struck a reef where two seas met, and they ran the vessel aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. And the soldiers' plan was to kill their prisoners, that none of them should swim away and escape. It was understood as a soldier, if you were guarding someone, it was his life or yours. And so the soldiers, just automatically, they were trained, if your prisoner's going to get away, you kill him. That way he ain't going anywhere. And so right away, they want to kill them all. But now their commander steps forward, verse 43. Julius, the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention, and he commanded that those who could swim jump overboard first and go on ahead to land. And the rest that didn't know how to swim, they can follow, some on planks, others on various things from the ship. And thus it happened that they all were brought safely through to land. So here clearly we have Paul delivering this company by the grace of God and bringing them safely through, as only God can do. All of those on the ship, because of their association with Paul, and his witness to Jesus Christ, they're saved. It's the same thing for you and I today. Because of people's association with us and the Christ that we proclaim, they too can be saved, become part of the family of God, and go to heaven with us. That's what we're supposed to be about, isn't it? We may not always experience smooth sailing in life, as I started with my story of Tempa, but we can trust God to bring us through the difficult storms of life. Storms come into our lives. They're designed the word is test, to test us, and it is to purify us, to get rid of more of me, and so I'd be filled with Jesus Christ and learn to trust him more. It develops my relationship with the Lord. And he will bring us through. When storms come our way, what does he want us to do? To trust him, to get on our face before him and pray to him. James chapter 1. Does any of you lack wisdom of why you're going through this right now? Let him come before God, who delights to tell you what's wrong and what he's trying to fix or why you're going through this. And he will do that for us. No matter what may be facing us, God desires to help us. Do you believe that, folks? Do you believe God loves you? How can he show us more that he loves us than to send Jesus Christ, his son, to die for us? Our primary purpose in life is to bear witness to the resurrected Christ. That's the Great Commission, isn't it? That's what we want to be about here. We want you to fall in love with Jesus so that you will believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. As you study more about him, so that you will just start to live for the Lord Jesus Christ and share him with others. Be a witness for him. And then, believe it, live it, and go tell others. Okay. Jesus lives forevermore to deliver all who accept him from certain death and destruction. That's our promise. That's our hope. That through Jesus Christ, we will experience God's blessing. The reason he created all of this is so that we might live to bring him glory. And in bringing him glory, we do that by sharing Christ and God's plan with others, don't we? Anybody else got one quickly as we close?